Thanks for downloading Think from KERA 90.1 Dallas-Fort Worth. You can learn more and support this program at kera.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Lindblad Expeditions, exploring nature's wild, unspoiled places aboard its ships in partnership with National Geographic. Details at 1-800-EXPEDITION.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much do you know about Fort Worth? Do you think as much about its founding mothers as its founding fathers? For much of its history, the majority of Cowtown's top jobs went to men. But thanks to those courageous souls who dared to be exceptional, women have always had a role in public life in the city, influencing its art and culture, developing its intellectual and social welfare, and occasionally even showing off mad skills astride a bucking bronco. Katie Sherrod is a writer and producer. She has collected some fascinating stories as editor of a new book just published by TCU Press. It's called Grace and Gumption, Stories of Fort Worth Women. Katie, welcome to Think.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So Fort Worth has always been an interesting place. It's not quite the South. It's not quite the West. It's not at the border. It's sort of an interesting combination of all the cultures and influences that have been there. Did you find that that also sort of played itself out when you started exploring women's history in Fort Worth?
Well, yes. I think one of the things that struck me was how many of the women came to Fort Worth, as did many of the settlers, from the South. From Tennessee to Texas, you know, gone to Texas was a famous sign of the pioneers. And that was true of many of the women who came either by themselves or with their husbands, came from the South. But Fort Worth became a gathering point from all over over time. And because it was a military fort, of course, some of the women moved there because they were there with their husbands in the beginning. But Fort Worth was at the confluence of the Trinity River, and because it had that great river there, it was a natural place for a settlement. It had a fort, so it was a safe place to come, and so it became a magnet for settlement.
What was life like at the fort for the women who were living there and sort of working around there?
Well, there was actually a woman living there before the fort was there. She and her husband, Jane Woody Farmer was her name, and her husband was Press Farmer. And they actually were living at the site where the fort was to be built when the Dragoons appeared. And I think Jane was probably really relieved to see them because she and her husband had been living in a tent, and her husband had dug a dugout underneath it so they would have a place to hide in case of an Indian attack. So I suspect Jane was really, really glad to see all those soldiers arrive. But they did have to move because the Farmer family legend was that the commander picked their site as the best place for the fort. So they moved south of the fort. And her husband later became the sutler or the store manager for the fort. But Jane Woody Farmer was the first woman in Fort Worth. And then after that, Kate Arnold arrived. She was the wife of the commander, and she sort of became a mother figure for the fort. She, her piano was brought in, and so she would play for dances, and she kind of took care of the soldiers. There were some other women at the fort that were laundresses, and Joyce Williams, the woman who did the chapter on pioneer women, couldn't find their names, but she could find there were at least three laundresses, and they were interesting women. They often had a reputation for being kind of tough, but they did at least add another feminine presence to this very manly place that was Fort Worth.
Yeah, that was really interesting to read because I was unaware that at the time, laundresses were sort of thought of as not quite women of ill repute, but they were assumed to be just not very cultured, not very worthy of sort of the regular attention that a woman of the day might have received.
But they obviously performed a very necessary function for the fort. And I think they offered a softening influence, even though they had to be pretty tough women to survive out there. And there were other occasions. I mean, they would have get-togethers, and people would come together to build cabins or things. And then they would have dances and that sort of things. And they would have dances at the fort. They tell about one dance where the officers brought in girls from the surrounding farms. And often these girls didn't have any shoes. And so they would give them some of the soldiers' shoes. I mean, these were stiff leather brogans, you know. And can you picture these young girls dancing around, clumping around in these dances? But they said that everyone had a wonderful time. And one of the officers wrote home in a letter that even with no laces and these stiff cowhide shoes, the girls were still able to dance with graceless abandon.
There were enslaved African Americans living in Fort Worth even up to the time of emancipation.
That's right.
And it sounds like some of these women really, once they were freed, I mean, hit the ground running despite incredible obstacles against them.
Well, they did. And once they were freed, often the slaveholders would offer them some land or supplies, and because often they had been members of their family for years. And Delcy Johnson is one woman's name that we know. She was given 80 acres of land, a wagon, and a team of mules and a horse by the Lee family on whose farm she had been a slave. And she and her husband Robert, who had been a slave on the Mosier plantation, built a one-room log cabin, and they dug a well on their land. And then they asked and invited other freed men and women to come join them. And they became the founders of the community of Mosier Valley, which is just northeast of Fort Worth. So they, you know, left servitude and became founders of a community, which I think speaks to the amazing resourcefulness of coming out of being property to becoming a property owner and then sharing that with other people.
And one woman who I guess did not start here but moved to Fort Worth after her husband died was the first registered nurse coming from the South who was African American. Is that correct?
Yes. And she was, I'm blanking on her name right now, but I will be able to tell you in a minute. She was an amazing woman and worked for many of the most prominent of the white physicians in town. So, you know, she had to be really, really good if she could work for the white physicians. The African-American women were just amazing. Essie Stearns was another woman whose name has been forgotten, but 4 years prior to Rosa Parks refusing to leave her seat, Essie Stearns took the same stance on a Fort Worth City bus and was arrested and faced the same problems. It's just she didn't become as well known as Rosa Parks. So the African-American women in Fort Worth were amazing. There was a Dr. Aurelia Harris, who was a chiropractor, who was very concerned about the welfare of African-American women. She worked hard to take care of young African-American women who found themselves pregnant without being married. She was one of the first people who did direct mail marketing. She knew she was going to build up her practice. She had to get it known. So she sent out flyers in the mail, one of the first people to do that.
Another doctor that brings to mind is, now I'm blanking on her name as well, Dr. May Owen, of course.
Oh.
Who worked into her 90s.
Literally up to about the day before she died.
Which is amazing. As a physician, can you talk a little bit about her?
Well, she was born of a very poor family, one of, I think, 12 children, a very large family, and knew from the time she was a small child she wanted to be a doctor. So one of her brothers said he would help her. So she came to Fort Worth. She got her degree, and she went to work. And her life was her medical career. She never had a home. I mean, she lived in a hotel. She didn't own sheets and all of that thing. She said it was just things she didn't want to be bothered with. Her other great passion was the Tarrant County Junior College system. And she guarded that school's budget like it was her own. But she was so dedicated. She didn't want them to name buildings after her.
But they did so anyway.
They did so. But she was, I mean, I think one of the things I've learned from this book, excuse me, is that work keeps you young. Because Dr. Owen was just one of the many women in here that lived to, a ripe old age, but worked also at a job she was passionate about up until almost till the day she died.
And there's a great history also in Fort Worth of women really having a tremendous impact on education. Let's talk for a minute about the Sisters of Our Lady of Victory.
Oh, well, you know, Our Lady, OLV, is an icon in Fort Worth. And one of the things that I learned from that was how critical it was to the education system that those nuns came to Fort Worth. And, you know, they were dedicated to building up an education system and did so. They had girls coming in from ranches. I mean, almost before their doors were open, ranchers had driven their daughters into town.
To drop them off there.
To drop them off to say, here, please educate my daughter. One father who was not a Catholic, but whose daughter wanted to, had promised his wife he would raise his daughter as a Catholic, brought her in, even though the Klan protested him doing so. And she eventually became a nun herself. But the sisters were so respected and so loved in the city of Fort Worth that even though their Catholicism may have been a bit suspect in the homeland of the Southern Baptist Convention, they themselves were and remain beloved figures in the city of Fort Worth.
And how long did the school stay open?
Well, the school itself, I'm not sure I know the answer to that.
I want to say 50s or 60s.
I know Brenda Taylor Matthews, who wrote this chapter, mm-hmm. would have been able to tell. But I think it was in the 60s that they finally closed. The building is still there, and some of the nuns are still there.
And there are condos now or apartments in one of the buildings, which is a great way, you know, to preserve it if it's...
Well, Fort Worth is good about imaginative reuse of their properties, and I think OLV is one of the examples of that.
So there was OLV. There was also a huge movement by women to make sure that Fort Worth children got to go to kindergarten at a time when it was considered to be almost a radical notion that you would send your 5 or 6 year old away from home.
The free kindergarten movement was a very important movement. The club women were involved in it. Many of the philanthropists in town were involved in it. You know, the club women of Fort Worth were amazing. And the Women's Christian Temperance Union women. You know, there have been a lot of jokes over time about, you know, Carrie Nation and the Women's Christian Temperance Union. But, you know, those women were fighting alcoholism and drug abuse. They were fighting child abuse. And those women and the club women, often who were the same, were so responsible for so many of the institutions in Fort Worth that serve children. One of our chapters is called In the Interest of the Children because that was a phrase that the women used over and over again to describe what they were doing in the interest of the children. The Fort Worth Children's Home, even the philanthropists. So many of these chapters, the women, we had fights over who was going to get which woman.
And some of them end up in multiple chapters.
And some of them are in multiple mm-hmm. chapters. Missouri Matilda Nail Cook, isn't that a wonderful name, is one of the most noted philanthropists. And there's a wonderful story about how she got her fortune. Her father had left all the children some land. One of her brothers kept badgering her about a piece of land, and eventually her husband bought that piece of land from her brother, and he joked that he had really pulled a fast one over on her. But it turned out to be on that piece of land that oil was discovered. And the story of how the oil was discovered was the truck was driving out to where they had originally planned to drill, and they ran into a mud hole. And the truck broke down, and so they decided to drill right there. And they hit this enormous gusher that is still producing oil, but produced a huge fortune for Missouri Matilda Nail Cook. And she used her wealth to start what eventually became Cook's Children's Hospital.
It's amazing when you talk about the club women, because that was the way that women were able to operate and sort of have it be socially acceptable, right? If they weren't forced to work by some other circumstances.
Well, and it also was a way for them to get education. They didn't have access to men's clubs with libraries. There were few public libraries, so they started them themselves. But they also eventually got the equivalent of college degrees through these clubs.
It's amazing. Katie Sherrod is my guest. She's the editor of a new book published by TCU Press called Grace and Gumption, Stories of Fort Worth Women. We will have many more stories after the break. If you've got a memory of something that may have happened in Fort Worth's history or perhaps a question about a Fort Worth woman, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or you can email think@kera.org.
Mm-hmm.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering adults an opportunity to think for credit. Details on the web at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Katie Sherritt. She's the editor of a new book called Grace and Gumption, Stories of Fort Worth Women. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Katie, how did the suffrage movement come to Fort Worth, and what changed because of it?
Well, many of the club women had been trying to get some social change in the laws through the Texas legislature. And, for instance, one of their battles was to try to raise the age of consent from age 10 to age 15. Texas had been blacklisted by many of the social justice agencies, because the age of consent was so low. Well, they went to Austin and campaigned, and they succeeded in getting it raised to 12. And the women were so horrified by that that they realized they had to get organized to get the vote if they were going to truly get the reforms passed that they needed passed. And so these women didn't do it because they felt they, you know, needed the vote to promote themselves. They were trying to do this for the children, and it was almost always the good of the children that was the driving force behind these women. It was only later that it began to evolve into the realization that it could better their own lot, too.
So they felt initially like their causes needed to be voted for by them.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And then, of course, it later evolved in the 1920s of women running for office for themselves. And we have a whole chapter called Braving the Smoke by Cindy Smolovic that talks about women who braved those smoke-filled rooms and ran for office, some as early as the 1920s, but then it particularly accelerated in the late 50s, 60s. And then, of course, with the women's movement, it took off. Mm-hmm. And it's hard for us to realize now when we have Kay Granger in Congress. We've had Kay Granger as a mayor. We have a woman running for president, that how difficult it was for us often to just find the first names of some of these women.
Because they were called Mrs. So-and-so.
Mrs. John Jones or whatever. And in every reference to them, it was with their husband's name. And so often the contributors to this book had to spend a lot of time digging through records just to find the woman's first name. And that was one of our big things, was that we were going to call these women by their names, not by their husbands' names. But it turned out to be a bigger chore than we thought. And it's often a hard thing to find women, because their names often change. You'll find a woman and then lose her again because she married a second time after being widowed. And then you have to find out what her husband's name was and start all over again. And also, a lot of information about women is held in private sources, diaries, family letters, things, boxes kept in people's attics. They're not in public collections. And so one of the things we're all very excited about is that the Fort Worth Public Library is starting a woman's archive in their local history department. And the librarians at the Fort Worth Public Library and at the University of Texas at Arlington Special Collections were so amazing in helping us dig out these women and find them, because women are hard to find. And so with this new women's archives at the Fort Worth Public Library, we're hoping that women's families will begin donating their papers and valuing the stories of these women as much as we have historically valued the stories of men.
Katie Sherritt is my guest. She edited the brand new book, Grace and Gumption, Stories of Fort Worth Women. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go first to Carolyn in Plano. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that one of the heroines in our family was my grandfather's aunt, Anna Shelton. And
oh, yes.
She founded what later became, I think, the Federated Women's Club in Fort Worth.
Yes, and she's very prominently featured in this book.
She was quite a character, I think.
Yes, she was a very determined woman.
She was, and she was also a very thrifty one. I can remember when I was a small girl. I'm 70 now. And when I was a small girl, my mother used to get care packages from Aunt Anna with clothes in them that she perhaps thought that we girls could wear. And I'm not sure they were ever quite appropriate, but I certainly think her heart was in the right place. But she was a fabulous woman. I've got an old cookbook from the club that has her picture very on the very front of it. And she's been a real heroine in our family. So I'm glad this book has come out.
Well, she's a real heroine in the city of Fort Worth, and we very much appreciate your call. And you know, think about donating the things you have from Anna to a public library somewhere so it will be accessible to people doing this kind of research in the future.
Yeah, what happens to those collections? They remain publicly accessible, sometimes with special permission, but everyone for generations to come will be able to find those documents and things, right?
Yes, and the librarians will go through them, catalog them, list them, and for much of it, it will be made available online. There's so many archival databases available online that research is amazingly much more easy than it used to be. You don't have to travel to Washington, D.C. to go through the archives of the Library of Congress. So much of it is online now.
Is it at all, does it bother you at all that there's a women's archive of the library, that somehow these things are still sort of categorized and separated out from what we would consider to be general interest history in a lot of places?
Well, I suppose, I guess I could be bothered about that, except the more I think about it, the more I think it makes it easier to find them than if they're lost in the vast sea of the general archives. But also I think it does hold up the special contributions that women have made. I mean, women do view the world through a lens that still, for whatever reason, is different from that of men. We're still the ones that are primarily responsible for taking care of children. And I think that does change the way women often look at the world. Not all women, but many women, they do view the world through the reality of how is this going to impact my child? And it changes the way you think about things. It changes the way women think about war, for instance. It changes the way economics impact women, because women a mother never just thinks about her own welfare. She's always got to think, how can I feed my child, not just myself? And one of the things that we saw all through this book was how many women went to work after a husband died because they had to feed themselves and their children. And this was in a time when women didn't work. And so you had people like Ninia Baird, who started Mrs. Baird's Bakery, because she had to feed her family, and she used the talent she had cooking to feed her family. Mama Polito, who started the Polito's restaurant, she was feeding her husband, who was a railroad worker, and her children, and he shared the legend is he shared his lunches with his coworkers, and they went, we want some of that. And she started cooking for them, and eventually it became the Polito restaurant. And, I mean, Mama Polito founded a little empire, and she was a small woman, but I mean, she ran that family. She ran their finances out of her little back pocket. She knew to the penny how much money they had, and she knew when they could buy another little rent house, or they could buy a bigger house for themselves, or they could add on to the restaurant. She kept it all in her head.
And there were, I guess, certain occupations that were considered acceptable even in those times, even for women who were in sort of dire straits, and others that weren't. And one of the places it seems that a lot of women gravitated toward was journalism, which really surprised me.
Well, you know, women have always been writers, and just like women have always worked, but they don't often get paid for it. But I think what fascinated me in doing this chapter on journalists was how early on women were working for newspapers. Somehow I didn't realize it had gone back that early. And the fact, I was also surprised, I guess at some point I knew this but had forgotten it, that Katherine Ann Porter had worked for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram.
Yeah, and I thought it was great that she tried to get hired by the Dallas Morning News and they wouldn't hear of her. And so she went over and got a job in Fort Worth.
And, you know, she obviously became a world-famous writer. But she was interested in the theater, and so she she shows up in our chapter on the theater and the arts. Like she was one of those many multifaceted women that had to be in more than one chapter. You know, another woman that a lot of people don't know is from Fort Worth is Ginger Rogers.
Yeah, that was she got her start sort of accidentally dancing, right?
A Charleston contest, and she also had been taking lessons from Eddie Foy, who then had taught her to do some dancing. When his sister got ill and couldn't perform, he recruited Virginia, and she stepped right in and performed beautifully. And after she won her Charleston contest, her career really took off then, and of course ended up dancing with Fred Astaire, doing everything Fred Astaire did, backwards and in high heels.
Thank you, Ann Richards, for that. And maybe one of the best quotes ever. In fact, that's from that chapter, which I loved, called There's Nothing So Useless as a Showgirl. And there were a lot of women who really had very successful careers, just starting here in Fort Worth, but then far beyond. Can you talk for a little bit about Stutterin' Sam?
Oh, Stutterin' Sam. She's in that chapter, There's Nothing So Useless as a Showgirl, by Jan Jones. You know, in 1936, Fort Worth was going to put on a show to rival anything Dallas could do. So they hired Billy Rose to come in and do the Casa Manana show. And it had, it was anchored by Paul Whiteman and the fan dancer Sally Rand. You know, it's a little bit
racy,
shocking.
Right?
Yeah, racy. Anyway, he was going to have all these chorus girls. Well, at age 21, Mary Dowell was 6 feet 2 inches tall. And, I mean, she had, as you can imagine, she was teased by her classmates, and she had a speech impediment. She stuttered. But when she read about this, she thought this was something she could do. Well, she stumbled into one of his rehearsals and really, really annoyed him. And he, you know, Billy Rose was little. He was like 5'2". So he's looking up at this very tall woman, and she can't get her words out. So he's going, "What do you want? What do you want?" So finally he hands her a notepad and says, "Just write it." And she said, "Please give me a part in your 6-foot chorus." And he hired her and turned her into a stunning showgirl.
And she was big enough and strong enough to sort of carry these heavy costumes and,
some
all that.
Of these costumes were amazing, with, you know, 10-foot wide pair of wings once when she was the Angel of Peace. These 1,200-yard train. Can you imagine trying to even stand up with that on? There's a picture in the book of her, and she is absolutely stunning. But she had no illusions about herself. She said when she moved to New York and men would be courting her, she'd say, "They call me a beauty, but I know what I've got."
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Katie Sherrod is here. Her book is called Grace and Gumption, Stories of Fort Worth Women. I have an email from Nicole in Fort Worth who says, "I'm interested in finding out more about the Catholic Ladies Aid Society, which did social service work in Fort Worth in the 20s. Do you know any stories about their origin or the work they did?"
I don't know about that, but I would certainly be interested in learning more. Maybe she can email some what she knows about it to your show, and we can follow up on that, find out more about it.
And where would you recommend that people who have things, particularly local history, which can be tougher to track down in some ways, where would you send somebody to start looking for things like this?
Well, things like that, I would start with the Catholic Diocese office, and again, the Fort Worth Public Library. I mean, they have amazing resources. But the diocese can often put you in touch with sources for their own history. And again, we found the best thing was to find relatives of people who had that information. And I think all of our contributors went and did one-on-one interviews with daughters or granddaughters or grandsons of the women featured in this book, and often found some of the best stories, like Anna Shelton's relative who called in and told the wonderful story about Anna sending the clothes that weren't really appropriate for little girls, but her heart was in the right place. And Pauline Naylor is one of the journalists that I wrote about, and I interviewed Pauline's granddaughter, who still works for the Star-Telegram, but her wonderful stories of how Pauline would come in from work, and they worked in hats and gloves, and she'd come in and she had to fix dinner, and she'd take her gloves off and start cooking dinner, and she would never even have taken her hat off.
She's bringing home the bacon and frying it up.
That's right.
next few minutes later. Can you talk, I found the story of Adele Jackson Martin really interesting because she really had two ladders to climb, first as a woman and also as an African-American in a time when neither one was particularly welcomed in the workplace.
That's right. And she was an African-American journalist in Fort Worth, and she was one of the pioneers, journalists forget whether white or black, and she worked for a white man who had started this company, and she essentially ran the company for him for many years. And she attended classes at TCU before TCU was open to black people. She worked with John Howard Griffiths when he was doing his, epic work.
Black Like Me.
She was one of the people who she coordinated what he was doing with the FBI to make sure he was safe. I mean, it's hard for us to remember how dangerous it was for a white man to be doing what he did during that time.
We should remind people, this is when he sort of colored his skin and went, and he was a white person trying to see what the black
experience
might be like.
He lived as a black man and then wrote about it. And in a way, and with a power probably at that time that only a white person could have done with that much credibility, sadly. But Adele was the reason that book got done, the research got done, and got published. And she was very, very courageous. She was very outspoken, and she would negotiate with her boss for her money, but he would often he gave her a Cadillac one time instead of the bonus she was promised. She said she didn't need a Cadillac. She wanted the money. And many of the women, the Association for Women Journalists did a tribute to some of our pioneers several years ago and interviewed a number of the women in my chapter who, thank God we did that, because we've lost so many of those women. And without those interviews, we would have lost so much of their story, the first person, their telling of the story. So, if you belong to an association like the Association for Women Journalists, encourage them to capture their own history like the AWJ did, because it was an invaluable source for this book.
It does make you want to make sure that we don't lose a single one of these stories as we move forward.
That's right.
My guest is Katie Sherrod. She is editor of a new book called Grace and Gumption, Stories of Fort Worth Women. We'll return to the conversation in just a moment. You can join us on the telephone line at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering adults an opportunity to think for credit. Details on the web at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Katie Sherrod. She will be at a book signing at the Barnes & Noble on University Drive in Fort Worth this Saturday, November 10th at 2 o'clock. You can meet her there, get a copy of the book, and that answers Greg's question via email, which is it available at local bookstores? I guess it is.
Yes, it is. And all of the contributors to this book will be there. There were 14 of
us. Wow.
And I hesitate to call this my book. I edited it. I wrote one of the chapters. But all of the women that worked on this book are volunteers. And these are women. They're academics. They're teachers. They have jobs. They have families. And yet they put their hearts into doing this work. And I can't say enough. Hollis Weiner wrote about the Jewish Women's Americanization School, found these wonderful stories of how they taught these people that were coming in from Eastern Europe, not just Jews, Arabs, anyone that was coming in, and would find a way to connect with them so that they could learn the language and pass their citizenship tests. Cindy Smolovec wrote about the political women Carol Roark wrote about cracking the glass ceiling, the business owners like Ninia Baird. Mm-hmm. For the price of a good cigar, I love that title. Susan Petty wrote about the artists and the writers and some of the actresses, although we also had Mudhole's Fairy Godmothers and Choir Bells, another title by Ruth McAdams. And, I mean, the stories they came up with, the way they found to frame them, the struggle we had to it was like putting 5 pounds in a 2-pound bag. You know, we had so much information, and we were trading information. We all became kind of a community, because if I was working on one of my women, and notice I call her my women, yeah, and found something about one of Sandra Guerra Klein's women, I would call her and say, did you have this piece of information? And so we were emailing each other sources and sharing information and bargaining about who got what part of which story. We sat on Judy Alter's front porch and drank a lot of wine and told each other these stories first. And I think that helped us shape the stories as we told them to each other. Because a lot of the authors of these chapters are academics, and they are used to doing a more academic kind of writing, but they quickly got that we were after the stories, and I think thoroughly enjoyed a different kind of writing than they were used to, and obviously we're very good at. And so for me, you know, I'm one of the few people yet, because the book is just out, that's actually read all of the stories. And so I feel so privileged to have been involved with all of the chapters. But, you know, I'm just one part of the team that put this together.
Katie, for a book like this one, so many of these stories have been sort of collected and stored and preserved in places that were different from where, again, the sort of mainstream history would have been. How do you think in the future women's history will sound different, in that it sort of resides in the same places where you might record the history of men or of men and women together?
Well, hopefully in the future, one, it will be much more easily accessible. And I think, obviously, the Internet is a tremendous resource. I mean, people are now blogging, and some of those blogs are telling stories of families now. If we can save some of those blogs in ways that I don't even know how to envision yet, those kinds of stories could become incredibly valuable to historians of the future. You know, somewhere out there, there's a teenage girl blogging who may end up doing some amazing thing in the future, and they will have access to her thoughts, her dreams, in a way that never was possible in the past. And, you know, so I think little girls should be thinking about, as they go to their myspace.com and places like that, think about that they are actually writing the history of the future now, and be aware of that when they do their blogging.
Yes.
But, you know, blogs are just one part of it. I mean, how are we going to even store information on disk? I mean, paper, I think, is still going to be the fallback, the default position. But things are being stored in cyberspace now that are accessible. But, you know, you wonder, if something terrible happened, would we lose access to all that information? You know, I can't even envision how the future is going to change the way we collect and save information.
What do you think feeds curiosity about history? What makes people, because it seems some people love it always, and other people come to a place in their life where they really want to know the history, especially of their community, of the place where they're from.
I think it happens for a lot of people when they have children, and they begin to tell their children, well, this is what it was like when I was a little girl or a little boy. But I think for other people, it's wanting to connect with the community. They want to know how they fit in to the place where they're living and working and having their being. And that's why it's so important we not lose the stories of women, because without those stories, you don't have the totality of the experiences that shape the community that you're living in. And I think as people mature, as they vote, like hopefully everyone did today, and they want to have an impact on the place they live, they want to know more about the people that came before them, that built the community that they're trying now to either preserve or change or improve.
Are there a couple of figures that, you and the team of women that you worked with really, really wanted to include, but somehow they're just the information was too fragmentary, or you weren't quite there yet?
Oh, we all had some women like that. I think one of our biggest problems, of course, were finding records for minority women. I mean, Sandra Guerra Klein did an amazing job with the Hispanic women, but you have a culture there, particularly in Fort Worth, where the men came to do the jobs and the women followed them. And like all of American culture, the men's stories had a tendency to be saved more than the women did. But she found, you know, family scrapbooks, families that were willing to save, share pictures and things like that. And she did a lot of oral history work. And so she pulled those stories out. Same thing, Phyllis Allen ran into that same problem with African-American women. And again, it's the problem of finding where those records are stored. Both of these women did amazing jobs in finding those stories, mainly because women in those communities had helped save some of those stories, too. Lenora Rolla in Fort Worth had, you know, done a huge job of saving an African-American archive.
So the stories keep coming in.
The stories keep coming in. Mm-hmm. And we have to, you know, that's why we didn't call this book The History of Fort Worth Women. We called it Stories of Fort Worth Women because we know we haven't written the definitive history. We've just barely touched the surface. We've gotten the stories into a public place, and now we hope that other people will build on this work.
How did you decide where you wanted to go? You couldn't have 200 chapters. I suppose you could have if you had another. And you were saying the book took 9 months to put together, which is symbolic in a lot of ways. How did you finally decide how it would all come together?
Well, that was an evolutionary process. We massaged it. Judy Alter and I and Ruth Carbach had lunch together in the spring of 2006 to talk about finally doing this, something Judy and I had talked about for years. And we sort of came up with a list of names of women, which was much too long. But then we began dividing them into categories, and we kind of came up with a rough list then, which astonishingly is not too far off from the list we ended up with. And then we started calling up the contributors and seeing, once we got all of those people on board, we all got together, and it was a collaborative effort. And some of it, sadly, was determined by how much information we could find. And we did have one rule that the women in the book had to be deceased because, you know, Fort Worth, one of the charms of Fort Worth is that it's a large city, but it's like a very small town. And we knew if we didn't have some rule like that, we would end up leaving out some woman who was very important and offend all those people who love her. And so we had to make that rule. There are two exceptions to that rule. In the book that I made as editor, Jacinta Jara in the Hispanic community and Hazel Harvey Peace. Both of these women are of a mighty advanced age and increasingly frail. And they were also are pivotal figures in their communities. In our community of Fort Worth. And so they were included as sources about other women, but at greater length than might have been the case otherwise.
It's funny that we've been talking about continuing to collect information. Ruth Carbach, who wrote The Modern Woman and Duchesses with Hearts of Love and Brains of Fire, which are two of the chapters in the
right.
book, has just emailed us and is very excited that Anna Shelton's relative, which was Carolyn, who called
right.
earlier, she said she's been trying to track her down forever. And Carolyn, if you are listening, we would love to be able to hook you two up. So if you could call the show back at 1-800-933-5372 so that we can get some contact information, I'm sure that Ruth would be delighted to hear from you.
Oh, I can tell you Ruth is delighted. Ruth is an amazing researcher. She probably helped every one of us, pointing us to databases we didn't know about. And so I can picture Ruth right now jumping up and down, excited about this information.
I have to imagine there are some people in this book that their relatives today, their descendants, will pick these books up and think, I had no idea that grandma did this or that, because they were also these sort of central figures within the home,
right.
and people weren't as concerned with what they were doing outside.
Well, think about your own family. I mean, I know that my mother, who I think of as this sweet, loving, amazingly intelligent woman, was also a nurse in West Texas at a time when my father and my mother were the doctor and nurse for three counties out there. Mother started the only well baby clinic out there for hundreds of miles to teach women about nutrition and child care and to give free immunizations. But, you know, I don't think of my mother as that adventuresome, pioneering woman doing all of that work. She's my mom, you know. And so it does kind of, it always catches me a little by surprise when I read a reference to that in her life. Or, and why would it surprise me? Here's this resourceful, incredible woman, but she's my mom, you know. And I think we all have to look beyond our moms to the young women they were, to the mature women they were, and find out what in them has shaped us, what our heritage is that we've inherited from them, so we can build on that.
Have you actually written her story down?
I am in the process of writing my mom's story down. And she and I took a trip to upstate New York, where she grew up, this summer to a family reunion. All three of her siblings are still alive. And so I did much interviewing then. And so I'm continuing to gather information, too.
And I guess it's one of those things that families really can all do. People don't have to be professional journalists or writers. They can sort of do this on their own, even with video equipment.
Video equipment, tape recorder. Just sit them down and say, start telling me your story. Because my experience has been, if you will listen sincerely, people love to tell you their stories.
Are Fort Worth women somehow fundamentally different than women anywhere else in America?
Oh, they're incredible. I don't know if they're not that I'm biased or anything. But the title, Grace and Gumption, just kind of grew up out of the stories we were hearing. And as we tried to think, how would we capture these stories, those words just kept coming up. And so, I mean, these women did have grace. They were feminine and loving, and they had gumption. They were, which is a good Texas word, I think, they were willing to take risks. They were willing to live boldly in a time when there were social strictures on what they could and could not do. They were willing to risk their, quote, reputations to do good for their community and for the children. They sort of strode out with a sense of holy boldness to change the lives of the people around them.
Holy boldness. That's a great phrase. Is this sort of thing taught in schools? Are kids who get Texas history also getting women's history?
I certainly hope so. I remember when I was in school, there was a photograph of this wagon train heading west, and the caption said, "The pioneers headed west with their cattle, their furniture, and their wives and children." And I remember
in that
thinking,
order.
What? I mean, if you'd read that caption, you would think, one, all pioneers were men. The women were baggage. Mm-hmm. You know, well, these women were not baggage. They were full and equal partners out there settling the American West.
It doesn't seem like they could have survived in any other capacity.
No, they had to, especially during the Civil War when most of the men left. The women in Fort Worth had to run businesses. They had to feed their families. They had to clothe their families. They had to be resourceful.
And they've been doing it ever since?
And they have been doing it ever since.
Katie Sherrod is a writer, producer, and editor of the new book, Grace and Gumption, Stories of Fort Worth Women. You can get a copy of the book and meet Katie at a signing on Saturday, November 10th. At 2 at the Barnes & Noble on University in Fort Worth. Katie, it's been great to have you. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's been fun. Thanks.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro, with production assistance from Maggie Conklin. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.